Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we're following the tangled attempt world governments are making to forge a global agreement to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Between the 1st to the 12th of June, negotiators from 190 countries meet in Bonn in Germany to work on a first draft of the text, which they hope will be agreed in December at the historic talks in Copenhagen. On the 21st of May, the new Obama administration in the US effectively set out its stall for Copenhagen when the American Clean Energy and Security Act was approved by the House of Representatives Energy and Commerce Committee. That legislation must now pass through the House of Representatives and then the Senate, but it's already been the subject of a massive lobbying campaign by industry. The key players in America's fossil fuel industries spent $44.5 million in efforts to kill and water down the bill between January and March of this year, according to The Guardian's Suzanne Goldenberg. The money went to industry front groups, lobbying firms, advertising campaigns for radio, TV and print media, and donations to key members of Congress. Just how deep some Democratic congressmen have gotten in with vested interests is illustrated by Rick Boucher, representing West Virginia, who over the past 20 years has received $750,000 from electricity companies, around $250,000 from mining interests, $250,000 from oil and gas interests, and $200,000 from chemical and related manufacturing industries. Boucher was part of a successful campaign to give away as many free pollution permits as possible to polluting industries and to increase the amount of offsets polluters can buy from overseas. After the weekend bill was passed by the committee, Boucher explained to his local paper that offsets would allow local electric companies to, quote, comply with the law while still burning coal, unquote. But the US continued support for cap and trade and its current level of ambition looks likely to threaten the credibility of any deal that is struck in Copenhagen. Earlier this week, I spoke to Oscar Reyes of Carbon Trade Watch to get his informed opinion of the state of play. Oscar was in Copenhagen as an observer of the World Business Summit on Climate Change when I called and asked him if he shared the general assessment that the US bill had been hugely watered down.
Yes, I do. I mean, the bill is colloquially known as the Waxman-Markey Act. And basically what's happened is it's the watering down of what was already a bad bill. Some of the fundamental proposals in that were to introduce a carbon trading scheme, a cap and trade carbon trading scheme, and to link that to what are called offsets, ways of paying someone else to clean up your mess so you don't have to. And at the level of international offsets, paying people outside of the country to do that, there was about 1 billion tons of those in the bill initially. To put that in some kind of context, the European Union's emissions trading scheme, a kind of equivalent scheme here in the EU, allows about 80 million tons of offsets in last year, and that was already bigger than the entire reduction commitment that was needed from the European Union in 2007. So this really undermines the need to take any action domestically. And in the process of negotiating this bill, they've actually increased that level to 1.5 billion offsets. And this in turn is going to drive a lot of really destructive, environmentally and socially destructive projects in the global south. So it's really a big blow. There's also various other ways in which the bill has been watered down in terms of all kinds of buy-offs and free allocations, which are going to generate a lot of windfall profits for some very dirty industries. So now what we're seeing is that whereas Obama had initially said, well, we will auction all of these carbon permits, which is basically just a way of sort of filling a hole in his treasury. Now he's saying, well, actually, we'll give 85% of these free to major emitters. So it's rewarding the people who are already causing the problem.
Right, so he's going to give 85% of these permits away?
Yeah.
So that's the polluter getting paid rather than the polluter paying?
Yes, the polluter getting paid rather than the polluter paying. I think it's also worth always putting this auctioning debate in some other context, which is what we start with is really a global commons. You know, the atmosphere is something that belongs to all of us in the globe. And when you're auctioning, it's still actually certain states appropriating a part of that commons for their own good. So whether you've got auctioning or you've got a sort of free giveaway of allowances, it's basically there's still a fundamental problem in terms of global equity of this issue, that it's appropriating value out of something that's the commons and rewarding that to the richest countries who are already the ones which have been fundamentally driving climate change.
But auctioning is thought to be a better system than just giving these permits away. And I understand that's what Obama actually campaigned on as well. He said it would be 100% auctioning. And that would have raised something like $646 billion over the first 3 years of the scheme for him to kind of spend, presumably, on kind of investing in low-carbon infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, his numbers, to be honest, I don't think his numbers really ever added up, and nor was it clear that those investments would go directly into to sort of green investments and renewable energies. That's not to say that there aren't other proposals from Obama and also in his climate bill that have been suggesting a real transitional shift to renewable energies, but those are really kind of outweighed by the way this whole scheme has been structured. Another point to add would be really that what they presume is a high carbon price, essentially. And well, I'm here at the moment at the World Business Summit, and there was a CEO of a major US energy company who actually defended and lobbied for this cap and trade scheme. And what he said was, well, to be honest, a carbon price is not going to drive the kind of shift that is going to see us invest in clean technology and renewable technology. Whether that carbon price is $20 a tonne or $50 a tonne is not going to change our investment decisions. And then he added, well, if there was such a thing as a price that was high enough to actually drive that shift, it would be politically unacceptable. So you can see the whole basis of that approach is something that's not really going to fly in the US.
That's amazing. That's somebody that lobbied for the scheme saying that the scheme isn't going to deliver what it's supposed to deliver.
Yeah, I mean, this is the CEO of a company called Duke Energy. And, I mean, he's here, and he's also on the board of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. I mean, there's also other sort of strange aspects of this story. I mean, for example, he was talking about the success of previous emissions trading, because actually, emissions trading really starts off historically in the United States with sulfur trading and trading nitrous oxide. And this affected power companies there, which was an issue around local environmental pollution. And this same company, which is pushing emissions trading now through the Senate, actually said, well, this system really works. But if you look at what they did under this system, they even ended up being sued by the Environmental Protection Agency for finding loopholes in the system and actually kind of avoiding their obligations to change to kind of a cleaner form of coal energy as it was then. So you can see that, I mean, this system is offering a lot of loopholes. And it's also what it turned out to do was delay change. Because another thing that's true across the board of emissions trading schemes in the United States, which include schemes called Reclaim, include now the RGDI, which is a regional carbon market, as well as also of the European Union emissions trading scheme itself. What's true of all these schemes and many others is that in the initial stages, they're over-allocated. What that means is that the polluters get more of these permits, generally for free, than they would actually need to start reducing emissions. So it's delaying the kind of changes that we all know are very, very urgent.
And they're very much vulnerable to lobbying. I mean, the caps, for example, aren't informed by the science. They're completely watered down continually by successful corporate lobbying.
Yeah. I mean, what you have is you have lobbying on different sides. And, again, one of the figures here at the Business Summit said, well, you're going to be hard-pushed to find a lobbyist in Washington at the moment because, in fact, you know, like, they're just all out on this case. And he said, well, 5.5 out of 6 are simply from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, taking these positions that really climate change is not an issue that we need to deal with. So still from this kind of head-in-the-sand ostrich position. On the other side, you also have industries who are now saying, well, okay, we recognize this as a problem. How can we make this fit our current business model? How can we make this fit our balance sheet? Which is still not grasping the problem, because what it's doing is trying to translate a climate problem into one that works for them without having to make fundamental changes. And those are a lot of the people then who are pushing the cap and trade scheme. And they're organized with some of the major, also NGOs like Environmental Defense, into something called US Cap, which has really pushed the cap and trade scheme. So you have lobbyists on both sides. What you don't have really, except for a few, unfortunately quite marginalized, sort of in grassroots, non-governmental organizations, and also a kind of vibrant climate justice movement there, is you don't have people in Washington saying, well, actually, no, we need to actually look at how we're over-polluting and over-consuming and actually do something to fundamentally shift to renewable energy. And where that's happening in the policy, it's happening only through sort of renewable energy standards, but these are being undermined by the trading framework within which they're being placed.
So the environmental NGOs in the States were supporting this kind of cap-and-trade system and a kind of weak original bill. And then due to lobbying in the first 3 months, and Susan Goldberg in The Guardian has kind of outlined the extent to which that's been going on, and you've just talked about it as well, that whole thing has kind of shifted yet again to a much weaker position from the US, really. And that's they're going to take this now to the UN negotiations as well, and this is not going to be inspiring for the way that the UN talks are going to go.
In a way, I mean, one thing to say is that some of the major environmental NGOs have lobbied for this as well. that's not across the board. For example, Friends of the Earth US has been critical. They put out a good report called Subprime Carbon, which drew attention to one of the other major problems with trying to use carbon markets to tackle the climate change problem. And in the case of that report, what they said was basically, well, you know, it's such a good idea to generate this system which draws in a commodity which they call carbon, but in fact doesn't represent any real-world object. And so no one really knows what it is. And then they build into the market all of these kind of derivative products. And so what we're going to see is a carbon bubble in the same way as we had a financial bubble. So what they were saying was, well, is this really a good way to structure environmental policy? So there are people who are critical on that score. The other thing to say is that actually things run somewhat in parallel. So the way the EU and the US have been setting up their cap and trade schemes, their carbon trade, their domestic and regional carbon trading schemes, is relatively insulated from what happens at the UN climate conference. The whole basis of the approach of the UN is rather similar. In other words, they're pushing carbon trading as the mechanism and international offsetting as the mechanism. But even if there's no agreement, these schemes will still carry on in the US and the EU regardless.
It's interesting that you talk about the links between the subprime crisis and what now looks to be developing in terms of the carbon markets. Larry Lohman was saying that a lot of the same people that were the original architects of the kind of financial deregulation and some of the kind of complex derivatives that drove the current financial bubble and subsequent collapse are the same people that are now trying to put this same architecture and lobbying for it in the States.
I mean, that's right. I think it's right both ideologically, in terms of, like, you know, the idea is how do you take the problem and says, well, how do you translate climate change into a form that is acceptable to a business which is used to and wants free markets? So in that sense, it's using the same ideological backdrop, but also, I mean, some of the key individuals. So for example, Richard Sandor of the Chicago Climate Exchange was also one of the real fundamental innovators, if you like, for derivatives trading and these structured investment products. And as the carbon market increases, more and more of these products are being seen and are developing.
I came across one news report that mentioned somebody called the Breakthrough Institute, and they've been doing some analysis which says that the amount of offsets allowed under the US cap and trade bill could mean that actual emissions in the US might not fall until 2030.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds about right. I mean, it's a similar figure from International Rivers. They said largely the same. They said about 2026. Although that was before there was this watering down. So, I mean, that sounds about right. And what this means also, crucially, is that we need to put this in the context of the kind of targets that will be agreed at Copenhagen. Because it's one thing to talk about strict and binding targets, but if those targets can be met without any kind of domestic action, in other words, you're saying the industrialized countries are outsourcing the problem to the global south, and we would say, well, the fundamental point is you have to actually make your transition domestically, and you have to start now.
And it's interesting what's been happening recently in the UK. The Tyndall Centre has done an analysis of the Climate Change Committee's first report, and it's basically coming down very critically of the use of offsets, saying that they basically encourage a more carbon-intensive development in the short term, so we're locked into kind of high-carbon development for decades to come.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth just seeing the kind of logic of these two systems. The idea of a cap and trade scheme is that you basically set a finite limit on emissions, and then the trade part of it is meant to make it kind of flexible as to where those emissions can be reduced. And an offset scheme is generating projects that can introduce new credits within the scheme. So effectively, an offset scheme is pumping up the cap. It's making more credits available. So it's immediately contradictory to the very logic of cap and trade. But what happens in the case of both schemes is anyway what's traded are not reductions, but things called reductions. Mm-hmm. And actually, I mean, this is really through the lobbying effect. There are many holes and loopholes in the scheme. So for example, of the EU emissions trading scheme, the country with the most overallocation was Lithuania. Lithuania had a high overallocation because it claimed that it would have to replace Ignalia, which was a Chernobyl-style nuclear plant, with coal power, and therefore it would need a lot of credits. Now, this claim was untrue, but it generated a massive surplus through this kind of lobbying, which it was then able to sell back to the UK so that power companies in the UK didn't need to reduce their emissions. And there are many instances of this, and the other side of the picture also, I mean, ArcelorMittal is the largest steel producer in the world, and we did some estimates that between 2005 to 2008, they've gained just a subsidy of over 2 billion euros in the surplus of credits they've had in this scheme, and without actually having to reduce any emissions. Now, offsetting further kind of introduces holes in these schemes, but it does so in a different way. It does so internationally. And what it does is basically, again, it's a form of reorganizing the problem. So an offset actually is not a reduction, although it's often claimed in the UN discourse an offset is reduction. In fact, an offset is a way of moving around an obligation to reduce emissions. But what it does is replace an obligation on, say, a single factory site that you might well manage or verify in one country with a claim to reduction elsewhere. And the way it does this is through a notion called additionality. It's a kind of Enron-style accounting. What they say is we can generate credits because we're doing something different to what we would have done otherwise. But of course, that's an unprovable claim, what you would have done otherwise. So what it rewards is good storytellers. And the good storytellers in this picture tend to be large corporations and large consultants who have a lot of resources to bring to bear on this.
Am I right in thinking that the original Obama platform was not to allow international offsets at all?
There was some debate. There wasn't, as far as I'm aware, there wasn't a clear position either way. But, I mean, they've clearly come down on that side. And the reason that offsets get introduced in these cap and trade schemes is partly as a result of, yeah, industry saying, well, we don't want to make change here, or this is going to cost us too much money. So it's a way of cheapening the scheme, but also making it less effective. So, yeah, there was some debate either side, but they've succumbed to basically heavy industry pressure.
The overall level of ambition in theory of the cap and trade bill, check me if I've got this right in the last version of the bill that went through, is about 17% cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, but compared to 2005 levels. So they're not even using the 1990 base level that everyone else is using.
Yeah.
So I think the EU have calculated that that translates to just a 5% cut when you compare it to 1990.
Those figures are broadly right. I mean, I think one other thing to add here that's important, if you start to trace back to 1990 levels, and you remember what happened at Kyoto. At Kyoto, Al Gore was the chief negotiator of the US, and he said, well, we will reduce our emissions by 7% on 1990 levels by 2012 on one condition. And his condition was that you put these kind of offsets into the climate change agreement. And we all know what happened next. The offsets got put into the agreement, and these offsets often represent a lot of hot air, a lot of non-reductions, because already in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet bloc, there had been reductions through industrial restructuring and decline that had nothing to do with a proactive climate policy. So already they knew there was a lot of this hot air floating around that they could buy cheaply from elsewhere. And then they also added this offset scheme to it. So, you know, the cost of agreeing to a binding target that Gore imposed was to undermine that target. And then what you had is, just in any case, the US withdrew from the scheme. So now you have a situation where Obama comes along and says, well, we'll bring our emissions back to basically the same level as they were in 1990 by 2020. And that was actually Obama's initial pledge. That they've actually kind of stepped back from where they were in terms of their binding targets, but they've also kind of imposed on the world a model that actually helps both them and other major polluters avoid meeting their targets too, and it makes really a nonsense of this notion of targets if you have such flexibility and such sort of double standard accounting that no one really knows when a reduction is happening or not.
As far as the UN process goes, they're moving towards a draft text for discussion at Bonn in the beginning of June, and people are basically saying, well, we'll commit to such and such a reduction. They're not informed by any kind of scientific cap or anything. They're just kind of saying, well, maybe we could reduce by so much. And the EU's position is, well, we'll reduce, theoretically, our greenhouse gas emissions between 20 and 30%. But if the US's position is, we'll reduce our emissions back to 1990 levels, the EU are going to presumably stick with their lower ambition.
Well, I suspect what will happen in relation to the US is simply that the US is going to have to move, and it probably will move. I mean, it's set out as its bargaining chips, if you like. But I think there's a more fundamental set of things that goes on here. One is that the EU has already been moving its position. So having talked about a 20% target and then 30% in the context of an agreement, a target, incidentally, which includes a lot of international offsets, and although the formally stated level is about 50% of this can be met through these international offsets, if you actually start to do the math of also sectors that are not covered by the emissions trading, which don't have the same limits on the number of offsets they use, we worked out that actually the EU's reduction would only need to also be around 4 to 5% in terms of what it set out in its 20% figure. Right. But its 30% figure, they've set two further conditions to that. One is that actually in counting 30%, they include what's called land use change and forestry, which they don't count in their 20% figure. So they've done a bit of a sly trick here, which is they changed the basis of their counting in a shift from 20 to 30%. And then the other thing they've done is they started to talk and build in more and more conditionalities on when they would adopt this 30% target. So the EU is not covered in roses in this story. The other point to make, though, is that actually if you look in the context of the overall UN negotiation, it's really not simply about targets, and I think it's quite restrictive for me to look at it just in those terms. If you look at what China and India and the G77 are pushing, a lot of their emphasis is, okay, what are we talking about finance? What are we talking about technology transfer? And I think we need to view the whole thing kind of holistically if we're going to see sort of the different pieces of the puzzle.
Is there anything else you want to add on those two points, i.e. what's going on in Bonn or the US cap and trade?
Yeah, on Bonn, I mean, there's a few things. I mean, at the moment, there's actually two sets of parallel negotiations, and they're going through these quite arcane-sounding working groups called Ad Hoc Working Group on Long-Term Cooperative Action, another which is an ad hoc group on the Kyoto Protocol. The attention is focused on the Long-Term Cooperative Action Working Group, which is where the new treaty has been negotiated. But a lot of the detail, and particularly around carbon trading, is happening in the other group. It's called the Kyoto Protocol Working Group. And in particular, what's being pushed is a proposal called sectoral carbon markets. Now, the EU has pushed this kind of proposal, and what it suggests is that this is actually going to tackle a lot of the offset problems because we're going to introduce targets for different kinds of sectors. If you look at it, what it is actually an expansion of carbon markets, reducing what are even the few small checks that are already there. And this has become abundantly clear at the World Business Summit here. The whole rationale for these type of schemes is to generate a larger market, because if you have all this demand for these offsets in the US scheme and EU scheme, they need to come from somewhere. And the schemes are structured at the moment is one project at a time. And in each of those projects has to put some formal reporting in about if it's making a difference, what have you. So they're looking to scrap that whole layer of checking and just say, well, according to some projection, this country in the global south would have emitted this much. So if there's a reduction relative to what their claims are, then we can start generating credits that are equivalent to offsets in the EU and the US. What that means in practice is that, again, what they'll count as reductions are not reductions. They're just going to be claimed reductions based upon somewhat spurious accounting and rhetoric, actually. And, I mean, there's also various other fudges and shifts around this in terms of, you know, changing the basis of counting from actual finite emissions to intensity targets, which is related to the intensity of emissions relative to GDP, which just means that you can keep growing your economy as long as it's getting more efficient, but that still generates more emissions. Three further points just on the different stances of negotiation. I mean, one is on technology. One of the key issues here is going to be around intellectual property. And at the moment, particularly India and China and the G77 are pushing for some relaxation of rules on intellectual property to allow for the more rapid development of renewables, which is being resisted by the US and the EU. So that's going to be quite an important battle, and there are progressive proposals on the table in that respect that more or less take the model of some of the generic drugs, actually, in the AIDS debate. And the other thing is on financing. I mean, one of the things is that through the mechanism of the G8 and then the World Bank, there's these things called World Bank Climate Investment Funds, which are highly controversial and actually invest in the same old coal and nuclear and CCS and a lot of dodgy projects, basically. And what some of the southern countries are saying is, well, actually, no, we don't want these to be counted as financing. What we want to be counted as financing is what passes through the UN process. And as imperfect as that is, there is at least a better kind of control or governance mechanism in that. So although it's far from the solution, I mean, these are kind of some of the more progressive demands that are within the process. I mean, the other thing that's really crucial here is something called RED, which is reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation. Again, this is actually going to introduce a whole new layer to carbon markets potentially. It's based on a tragedy of the commons argument. The idea is that deforestation happens because there is no value placed on trees and so people cut them down. I mean, this is nonsense from the point of view of anyone who's studied why deforestation happens. The major drivers are pulp and paper industry, palm oil plantations, infrastructure investments in mining projects in forested areas. And so to actually just say, well, we're going to throw some money at the problem to stop local people kind of accessing the land for sustainable agriculture is going to have massive effects on forest-based communities and indigenous peoples, but it also just fundamentally misses the problem and in the process creates land grabs. So I think it's really important to kind of get the message that on deforestation, these RED projects are not a good way to go. And what they need to look at is actually what are the fundamental drivers of deforestation.
Are there any kind of country groups that are actively fighting the inclusion of RED in the carbon markets?
Fewer country groups. I mean, there's a Bolivian proposal, which is of the ones out there the most progressive, and that's partly because actually they're more informed by indigenous voices, which have really been leading the struggle on RED, because they're saying, well, look, this is really fundamentally affecting our livelihoods and our ability to live. It's a survival struggle for us, and you're going to impose this scheme that is going to just introduce kind of further land conflicts and land speculation and ultimately kick us off our land, because that's what happened if you start to put these new schemes to incentivizing these kind of spurious developments. So they're actually leading the struggle, but although there's an indigenous caucus, they're not formally represented within the talks, because the talks are between nation states, between national governments, rather than, for example, including indigenous people, because they're not fitting within that nation state structure.
So similarly, with anybody trying to advance alternatives to carbon trading within talks, is that happening at all, other than kind of outside NGO voices like yourselves?
The Copenhagen Agreement is not going to be a good deal, and it's certainly not going to be one that gets rid of carbon trading. Most likely, it's going to expand it. I think there's a scope for work inside and looking at the detail of the process to try and kind of cut off and at least shine a light of public visibility and public opinion on some of the worst proposals in there. And hopefully it will be possible to stop some of those proposals going through. But actually, in terms of alternatives, we need to be looking beyond Copenhagen and beyond what we can kind of put pressure or demands to governments on, because actually the basic framing of that agreement is just highly problematic. So we need to really be taking kind of collective action, social movement action, also at very many different levels. I mean, you know, starting with the local, to actually say, well, no, we want different kind of climate justice-based alternatives to what is being proposed at Copenhagen.
Any final words on the World Business Summit there?
I mean, and what it is it's one of many marvellous lobbying opportunities for very large corporations to get the ear of the negotiators and people in UN agencies, governments, what have you. So, I mean, this is what presents itself as the progressive wing of business. But, I mean, to paraphrase what one speaker here said, it's like looking at the back end of a horse that's walking in the wrong direction. It's quite a sort of ugly sight, because what you have is some of them seem to have a genuine kind of belief that climate change is happening, but they're translating the problem into something that fits their current business model. And we would say, well, actually, that's not going to cut it, because it's the current business model that they've adopted that has been the problem in the first place. But what is going to come is some process of influencing the talks through various kinds of different working groups, and it's also working for the World Economic Forum. Some of this will be taken up through that body, through the UN Global Compact, through direct interventions. I mean, as we were speaking, I saw Yvette de Boer walking past me, who's going to be presented with the declaration from this summit. So yeah, there's clearly a process of influence going on there in shaping the talks to go actually in a direction that moves away from climate justice and away from real means to tackle climate change.
That was Oscar Reyes of Carbon Trade Watch speaking to me a few days ago by phone from the World Business Summit on Climate Change in Copenhagen, Denmark. The use of offsets under cap and trade schemes has been coming under increasing criticism from figures in institutions like leading climate scientist James Hansen, the UK's Tyndall Centre, and Andy Atkins, Director of Friends of the Earth, England and Wales. Purely from a position of self-interest, they delay the move to a low-carbon society domestically, causing high carbon lock-in and loss of first-mover advantage. To make the Copenhagen deal scientifically credible, it's important that the Obama administration raises its level of ambition and that other industrialised nations follow suit. As climate scientist Bill Hare has recently noted, nothing on the table for Bonn currently is anywhere near sufficient to keep us below 2 degrees centigrade of global warming, let alone the safer threshold of 1.5 degrees demanded by the coalition of 100 countries that are most immediately vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. We'll be picking up this story again next week, but in the meantime, references for this week's show can be found on the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org, where you can also listen to this programme again, or to any earlier programme you may have missed. Thanks for listening.